into the morning hours tomorrow. Otherwise, it'll be a mostly cloudy Saturday with little change in temperature. For Sunday, sunny, high 81. Monday, continued dry, perhaps a bit cooler with a high of 79. Right now, 66. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Before we get to today's interview, I wanted to mention that this weekend for the podcast version of the Morning Show, in honor of the start of yet another school year, we're going to be replaying a couple of very interesting interviews from the Morning Show archives. One of them with a woman named Jackie Drummer, who for a number of years worked with gifted and talented students in the South Milwaukee School District. And we had a very, very interesting conversation. Boy, now it's probably been 20 years or more ago that we talked about some of the special and invigorating challenges involved in working with gifted and talented students. I'm going to be replaying that conversation on Saturday, tomorrow. And on Sunday's podcast, a rebroadcast of an interview with the author of a book called Same, Separate, Different, which examines some of the interesting questions around same-sex education, that is, schools that are for all boys or all girls or all men or all women, and what some of the advantages and disadvantages are of approaching education in that way. That will be Sunday's podcast version of The Morning Show. Find the Morning Show podcast. Be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And now today's interview. The book we're talking about for this portion of The Morning Show has a great title, The Hit Charade. And it tells the amazing story of Lou Pearlman. He was the guy behind the scenes that helped bring to the public the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC. And he had, in addition to that, all kinds of various enterprises and projects and schemes. And many of them, maybe all of them to some extent or another, were fraudulent. And ultimately, Lou Pearlman went down in financial flames and is now in jail. And it's a twisted, checkered story, and it is a fascinating story and told so carefully by author Tyler Gray, who has covered all sorts of different topics in his career as a journalist. And he is senior editor at Blender magazine, and again the author of this fascinating book called The Hit Charade, which tells us the complex story of Lou Pearlman, his fantastic rise, and his brutal fall. The book is published by HarperCollins. And Tyler Gray, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate that.
Looking forward to this. This is not exactly a feel-good story. And I was joking on my blog, actually, a day or two ago that when I was on the treadmill, which is where I read almost all my books, By the time I was finishing up, I had ratcheted the thing up to 5 miles an hour, which for me is really fast. And the only thing I can attribute that to is just how, in a sense, how frustrated you get the more you read about this guy's escapades.
How did someone not catch him is the question.
Yeah. Explain to our listeners how you first encountered the name of Lou Pearlman, and in a sense, how your life even sort of brushed up against his, or at least his sphere of influence.
It's small town Orlando, and it's where I grew up. And physically, it's large, but it's a very tight circle once you get into the various subcultures. And the one that Lou obviously lorded over was the boy band world that was there and very pervasive. And they would, I'll just say that, you know, I was a waiter at a restaurant, and one of my coworkers ended up marrying a guy who was the vice president of one of Lou's companies. And years before they actually had made it big in Orlando, she was talking about this group called the Backstreet Boys, that they're huge in Germany, they're going to be huge here, just wait, you know, they're all going to be big stars, and you know, it's going to be bigger than anything you've ever seen. And we all laughed at her and, you know, told her to get back to the kitchen and grab her food because it was up and her tables were waiting on her. And she, for a while, had the last laugh because it came true. And when the boy band thing sort of broke, I was at the Orlando Sentinel newspaper and covering everything from courts and cops and crime, but eventually ended up as a nightlife writer, which meant I got paid to go out for a living and listen to music. And I kept running up against, you know, these young guys who were just millionaires and driving around and renting clubs and big cars. And sort of at the head of it all was this guy, Lou Pearlman, who everyone felt kind of weird about. It was like this whole thing seemed fake to everyone. And no one, you know, forget the music for a minute. It just seemed too good to be true. First of all, it was Orlando, and as much as you might like it, and as big a tourism capital as it was, it just wasn't this, like, cultural center. And for a guy to just rise as fast as that, it felt weird to a lot of us at the newspaper and just all around. And so, what we did, though, is we sort of failed to look into it as deep as we could have. There were a lot of dogged reporters on this case who've done a ton of reporting on it. Especially the Orlando Sentinel on the St. Petersburg Times, but none of us imagined how big it was. It wasn't until probably 4 or 5 years later, when I was at a magazine called Radar, that I started getting back into this and realizing how crazy it was, and decided to try and look back into it some more. And about that time, Lou Pearlman went on the lam. He took off because everything was starting to crumble for him, and he fled to Bali, Indonesia. And that sort of kicked off a chain of events where I wanted to go back and write some oversights, you know, that as a journalist I should have seen maybe a little more when I was back in Orlando. So I just sort of retraced the steps and loose steps in particular, starting with the very beginning of his life.
Or tried, at least.
Tried.
You know, it's interesting. One of the chapters, I guess it's chapter one, actually, we follow an accountant by the name of Paul Glover as he walks into the Orlando headquarters of Transcontinental Enterprises, which was sort of the headline or front facade of Lou Pearlman's empire. And at this point, the place is already in shambles,
right,
behind the scenes. And this accountant had been brought in to try to look things over and figure out what assets are actually there and how can the place survive. And he walked in and ultimately found 84 different corporations and limited partnerships,
right?
All under Lou Pearlman's auspices, and an absolute mess. Now, I was thinking, in some respects, you, as the author of this book, faced a similar sort of challenge as did this accountant, Paul Glover. I mean, to walk into a mess like that and to try to make sense of it. Of course, he had to try to, I mean, initially his charge was to try to fix this mess, and your charge was to write about this mess, but
right,
gosh, that had to be complicated.
Well, it was, and I mean, you're right about Paul Glover. He was actually a major catalyst for the story happening, and one of the first people I talked to when I was doing a magazine story about this, and it was because of people like him that I was able to unravel it. I mean, he did a lot of the heavy lifting, and there were other people that I found out did a lot of heavy lifting, too. I mean, the FBI was thick into this. The FDIC was big into it, but they weren't sharing. Not in the beginning anyway, and the FBI probably never will. But there are a lot of documents and thousands and thousands of pages I ended up going through and you know, using people who were intimately involved in this case and drawing it all out on a giant dry erase board and attaching post-it notes everywhere. And it ended up looking like a scene from The Wire at the end with the tree and all that stuff. But I mean, it's just the reason, it's the same reason he was never really caught, is because he had so many companies doing so many different things that it was the biggest shell game. You imagine like a shell game on a street corner with three shells. Well, he had about 84 of them.
Hmm.
He was sliding them around constantly, and he never knew under which one was the cash.
And ultimately, this all added up to being, in your words, one of the farthest-reaching, longest-running cons in U.S. history.
Right.
Ahead of talking more specifically about who Lou Pearlman was and kind of the arc of his story, I want to talk for a moment about your hometown of Orlando, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting to me how you say that in some respects Lou Pearlman, the scheming Lou Pearlman, and Orlando, Florida were sort of made for each other.
They were.
Or that is, this was, I mean, in a sense, the smartest thing he ever did was move his operation to Orlando, Florida, because
yeah.
It was exactly the kind of environment where somebody like Lou Pearlman was going to make a lot of money very quickly. Explain that point about Orlando, Florida itself.
You know, the only thing he could have done better was to go to South Florida. But that aside, it's a state that was founded on a scam. Swampland deals for developers who thought that they were buying into a piece of the Fountain of Youth, and it actually were moving into a swamp that they had to fill in if they wanted to make it thrive. And that sort of is the genesis of how Florida and Orlando and Central Florida in particular became this kind of dream factory. You know, add Disney into the equation, and here you have a place where you're supposed to be able to make your dreams come true, and all for a very, very low price. And it turns out, you know, just more times than not, covering development and covering the environment and covering crime in Orlando, you see that these people, you know, people move down there expecting a shortcut, that they, you know, they're gonna spend just a little for a giant McMansion and life will be swell. Well, suddenly the water pressure doesn't exist in that giant McMansion because the city didn't build the infrastructure. Or you're spending just as much money on a car and driving around than you spent living in whatever larger city you moved from to escape. And you know, Lou preyed on that sort of disappointment. You talk to the guy, and he's the sort of guy who will understand your dreams, hear them, repeat them to you, and position himself as a guy who will make them come true. And where better than in the shadow of Mickey Mouse to pull that off?
Hmm. And, of course, sort of a general public that has a fair number of people who might be taken in by those kind of overtures.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And let's not forget that there's also very, you know, I mean, there's actually laws on the books that make it comfortable for somebody like him. It's the reason, you know, O.J. and Effley Bailey and, you know, people like that have ended up with homes in Florida, is because of the Homestead Act, where as long as you don't borrow money against your house, you can keep it even if you go bankrupt, no matter how big and luxurious it is. Unfortunately, that didn't apply to Lou. He even borrowed against his house. So he lost that in the bankruptcy as well.
As you wanted to tell this story, how many doors remained closed to you versus how many people were eager to talk about their experiences with Lou Pearlman? I mean, his former colleagues and I suppose victims also. I mean, in the whole scheme of things, I mean, you obviously talked to a whole lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
How many people did not want to talk to you about Lou Pearlman for whatever reason?
Well, the biggest and most disappointing were members of boy bands. I mean, I talked to a lot of them, but the current ones, the ones with vibrant careers, don't want anything to do with Lou Pearlman or never want to be associated with him again. So, you know, anybody who's still in the Backstreet Boys or anybody who was in sync did not want to talk.
Hmm.
You know, got real close with Lance Bass, but he just, you know, he said a lot in his book, and he's a smart guy, and he's a classy guy, and he understands that there's nothing for him to gain necessarily by talking about Lou Pearlman anymore.
In fact, I don't want us to spend an undue amount of time with this, but one of the things you talk about in your book are the allegations that Lou Pearlman had inappropriate closeness, shall we say, with some of these young men. I mean, and the fact is he surrounded himself with young, healthy, strapping, cute young men, not only the performers in these bands, but always his chauffeurs and people that helped around the house, I mean, and so on. And there's just this sense that there is perhaps was something going on there that maybe should not have been going on. And do you think that suspicion is at the heart of why all of these performers do not want to be associated with him, that somehow
I guess
they would, their reputations might be damaged the more it's talked about?
That's certainly why they haven't, trying to use a different word than come out. That's why they haven't come out to talk about what may or may not have happened to them in many cases, because number one, it's that old thing, you know, the same reason that rape isn't reported most of the time. And it's a sad thing, but people feel embarrassed and they feel like they're going to be stigmatized. And the other thing is that, you know, they're in an especially sensitive line of work, and which is show business, and they don't want that sort of thing attached to them if indeed it happened. They've certainly had every chance. The road has been paved for people to come out of the woodwork and say, this happened to me, it happened to a bunch of people. If I didn't do it, certainly Brian Burrow in Vanity Fair did it when he published a story in 07 about that really focused in on that element of it. And yet no one afterward came out and said, you know what, this happened to me. You hear secondhand stuff instead. Somebody who knew that somebody was doing something, but maybe didn't see it for themselves, or maybe they did see it for themselves, so they won't say exactly who it happened to. And it wasn't in my interest to drag someone kicking and screaming into the light just to say that they may have been molested. For his part, Lou says that he absolutely did nothing inappropriate, that he never is romantically interested in men. However, he did surround himself mostly with underage boys, and if he was attracted to men, big deal. He certainly wouldn't be the first person in Hollywood or in Orlando or anywhere to be attracted to men. And that was never a big deal. What was a big deal is that here's a boss doing inappropriate things with his employees.
Right. I mean, that's where this is most troubling, I think, to most people, the fact that this smacks of sort of a workplace harassment situation, or somebody holding so much power over somebody else. That is really troubling, no matter what your opinion might be about something like one's sexual orientation. This is really not about that even so much as this other thing.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, about if you came to work one day and your boss wanted to give you a massage, you know, I mean.
And you're afraid you'll lose your job if you don't say
right,
yes.
Right, right.
Just one of many things that are troubling about this figure of Lou Pearlman. We're talking with Tyler Gray, and his book is called The Hit Charade. One of the things you had to go on, besides court transcripts and bountiful interviews and so on, Lou Pearlman had done some writing about himself, although you hasten to add that his own written accounts of his own life and the important influential events in his early life have to be taken with a grain of salt. So for you, sorting out just what his early life really was no small matter.
Right. I started with his autobiography, which was co-written with a reporter from the Orlando Sentinel, which was a little shocking, but it was shocking because if you go back to it and you start at the beginning and you talk to the people who he names, they tell a very different story than he does. He talks about buying a newspaper route from a former childhood friend for $500. Well, I talked to that childhood friend, and he says not only did he never give Lou his newspaper route, but he certainly would have remembered getting $500, you know, back in the 1960s or late 60s or early 70s, and of course he didn't remember getting that at all. He said no way. He said in fact when he got rid of his newspaper route, he gave it to his brother, and his brother laughed at the idea that he gave it to Lou. So piece by piece, these little things, starting at his remaking of his own life, falls apart from the get-go.
One of the things with which he first falls in love is the blimp.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about this...
metaphor.
that for one thing. But, yeah, this fascination he had with blimps and what he ultimately did about it.
Well, he grew up across the street from Flushing Airport, which is now closed, in Queens. And Goodyear had a hangar across there. So day in and day out, he could go watch blimps come in and out of this hangar, which is cool for a kid. And, you know, his particular room did not actually face the airport, but his neighbor, Alan Gross, did have a perfect view out of his living room window. And so they would go to Alan's house and they would watch blimps come in and out. Now, later, Lou would remake that story to say that it was his room that he watched the blimps come in and out of, but it didn't face the airport. There wasn't really, unless he stuck his head out the window and craned his neck, which I guess is possible. But so he buddied with this guy who lived down the hall, and they would watch these blimps together. And Alan had a true fascination from early childhood with blimps. And, you know, to this day, collects the memorabilia and all this stuff. And he... basically, Lou borrowed this fascination from his friend. He did develop one of his own, and he did want to try and go get rides on these blimps, just like his friend. But in his own book, he borrows stories from his buddy's life. you know, he followed in this guy Alan Gross's footsteps. He wasn't the first one to walk across the highway and go over to the Goodyear place and try and get a job as a gopher. He wasn't the first one to get a ride on a blimp with his parents. That was all Alan's life, but Lou borrowed that for his own story. Needless to say, though, he did get in tight with the guys from Goodyear, and he did sort of start working as a gopher for Goodyear and would eventually start his own blimp company and build a blimp of his own for a client, then the Cash Brothers, who had a startup company called Jordache Jeans. They wanted a giant, splashy way to advertise their business, and Lou promised them a fine-crafted German-imported blimp. What he did instead was he went out to California and got a logging balloon, hacked it up, and had it re-sewn in the shape of an actual balloon. They painted it with this sort of goldish-brown paint that turned an uglier brown in the sunlight. Slapped a logo on it, tried to launch it, and it spiraled into a crash in the first 5 minutes.
Around the time that he is becoming intrigued with flight, he is also intrigued by the life and career of his cousin, Art Garfunkel.
Mm-hmm.
And you tell us that a really significant event, I believe in the summer of 1967, was when he saw his first ever concert with Art Garfunkel at Forest Hills Tennis Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
You call it a pivotal experience.
Right.
Tell us how and why.
It was actually the Doors that really blew him away. Although he was there because of his cousin and he continued to follow his cousin intensely and definitely dragged him out whenever he could to sort of get himself close to fame, he saw this rock and roll lifestyle. He saw people being adored on stage. He was backstage, so he saw all that stuff too. And he sort of decided that at that point, that was what he wanted to do in some way. He wanted to have that level of adoration. And even for a little while, tried to do it as a rock musician, playing guitar in a band that he started and then later managed and then later screwed. But basically, he tried to be a rock star for a little while, but he just didn't fit the role. If you've ever seen him, you might kind of get that. You know, John Popper and Fats Domino aside, in rock and roll, there just aren't guys that look like that often. But it's interesting that that's what he inevitably returned to once he became successful.
And it is though he got a whiff of this life.
Definitely.
And wanted it. You tell us a little bit about this group called Flyer, mm-hmm. for which he actually was a musician, but ultimately his role shifted over, inadvertently or not, to being more of a behind-the-scenes man. And, of course, that really is what gives us a hint of what is to come.
Right. Flyer to this day calls themselves Lou Pearlman's first boy band, which is, and they say it tongue-in-cheek. But they were young guys and starting a band, and Lou promised them the world. He promised them all these millions of dollars in his assets to back them if they didn't have a record deal. Then he told them they had a record deal, and then somehow that fell through. And he told them they had a world tour, and somehow that fell through, too. And Lou just kind of disappeared. A story that didn't make it in the book but was interesting is that at one point, when the money wasn't coming through, Lou wanted to show them that he had best intentions that all he was waiting for was ironically an insurance settlement from that blimp crash, the one I just told you about. But so he took him to – I think it was Joe DiPaolo, one of the guys, to an ATM machine and tried to put his card in and – and it showed that he couldn't get the money out, and then the assets were frozen. So he used a weird thing like that to sort of show that he intended to do well, but couldn't. It was a strange story.
Hmm. Well, at some point, Lou Pearlman finds himself aspiring for more than just what he was experiencing through his Transcontinental Airlines firm. He wants to get into show business, and he told a story which you suggest was not true, but the big eureka moment where the idea came to him via some group he'd never heard of called New Kids on the Block.
Right.
It's not a true story, but because it's not a true story, it says a lot about Lou Pearlman.
It's probably not true. I mean, here's the thing. Certainly elements of it aren't true. He claimed to be operating a charter airline service at the time, which he was kind of. He was renting jets and then re-renting them to other people at a higher rate. But he was claiming those jets were his. And one of these groups, yeah, like you said, was New Kids on the Block, who were able to cough up the $250,000 a month fee for the charter jets. And he couldn't figure out how this group he never heard of, because he followed entertainment. How could they afford this? And he did what anybody does when they first walk into a museum and see for the first time a Jackson Pollock painting. They say, "Hey, I could do that." And so that was supposedly when he decided to start a boy band. Well, I talked to Maurice Starb very briefly, who started New Kids on the Block and is a legitimate talent scout, and he said that he couldn't remember ever having any deal like that with Lou Pearlman, and he would have been the guy to sign the check. So it was interesting that he could not recall that.
So, one way or another, he does get this idea that there is a huge amount of money to be made, and he's going to make it by transforming his transcontinental company into an entertainment company. And one of the most intriguing things about this is the fact that he takes all of these buddies and friends and so on, and just overnight, they all become executives in a completely different company.
Right.
You said, your words, they were all overpaid and underqualified before. And when he switches it over to entertainment, they're still all overpaid and underqualified. And they just do as Lou instructed them without asking any questions. But it's just sort of amazing to think about a company overnight becoming something completely different with all the same people in place.
Right. Now, I mean, some of them, were with Lou pretty early on in the blimp business, and they had learned the logistics of that. It's not rocket science, it's blimp science, and it's a lot easier to sort of figure out. However, it wasn't so easy to figure out when in the face of competition and in a new place, and when suddenly your job isn't just blimps but bands and entertainment. I mean, it really did switch a couple of times. And these guys, they were paid for something. It wasn't business experience or business savvy, and they certainly would have never made that same money had they been out in the open market trying to get those jobs. Hmm.
So this gets rolling. That is, this idea of forming an entertainment company and presenting a brand new group to the world with a relatively simple want ad in the Orlando Sentinel. Tell us about this.
I can't remember the exact text of it, but it was something about young men, dancers and singers wanted, looking for clean-cut dudes, and apply at Lou Pearlman's blimp warehouse, And that's where they were made to come and sing and dance and do a routine to show that they were fit to be in this new band.
So we are talking about a phenomenon that was already in place. That is, there was already something called New Kids on the Block, and I suppose that Latin group Menuda already existed.
Menuda, right. I mean, you could make the argument that it goes all the way back to the Jackson 5. I mean, that was the first boy band, and then there's New Edition, and then there's New Kids on the Block and Menudo, he didn't invent the whole thing, but he certainly brought it back.
Hmm. Well, and the way he did this is kind of intriguing. In particular, the lavish way in which he presented them to the world, and the money he was willing to pour into this effort to shape them and polish them and make them potential stars.
Mm-hmm. He definitely had an eye for what would sell with particularly teenage girls, which if you were to look at the Jonas Brothers today, it's not such a bad business plan. But he could tell when someone was too hard-edged or too weak on the dancing or the singing part, and he could spot talent. He also had a team around him that was really good at that, too. But he brought that team in, so you got to give the guy a little bit of credit for being able to scout talent.
I thought one of the most interesting points you made is that in spending all this money, $3 million in the early going, just on kind of launching them, you say part of his plot was to make the group look and sound successful long before they ever became stars.
That's right. This is a process that actually was pioneered by Clive Davis. And then Clive Calder sort of did the same thing as well. These are both big record industry people. You get a package ready. You ship it overseas where it's a smaller, easier market to break into. Germany in particular is a pop-hungry culture. And by the time the world in the U.S. turns toward that kind of music, you've got a ready-made, trained, prepared, proven package to sell. And that's what Lou had. No record label was going to dump $3 million into starting a band that may or may not make it. However, there's a guy out there who already did it. He spent his own money, and he was ready to hand them over. Then, yeah, let's do it.
Well, he ends up, of course, presenting this group called the Backstreet Boys to the public, and not too long after that, another group called NSYNC. One of the most amazing stories along the way you tell us is that NSYNC comes along, and they are really huge rivals to the success of the Backstreet Boys, and the Backstreet Boys don't even realize that NSYNC is another Lou Pearlman group.
Right. He kept that from him for a long time. And the genesis of them was pretty simple. Lou wrote a song for the Backstreet Boys. This is according to his business partner at the time, Julian Venture. Lou wrote a song. He wanted the Backstreet Boys to perform that song. And they said no. They didn't like the song and they weren't going to do it. So, Lou and Julian kind of say to each other, you think what I'm thinking? And they sort of nod. And Lou goes off and starts NSYNC, who will do whatever he tells them to do, and then positions them as the biggest competition to the Backstreet Boys, but doesn't tell them that it's his band. They find out eventually and are heartbroken, and that's when the sort of the lawsuits start, and people start to realize how deeply he is profiting off of this band that's only getting paid $300,000 after 3 years of rigorous touring and a billion in sales.
They ultimately really win the PR battle, don't they?
They do. Not necessarily the case against him, which is, I think, something that people might be misled about who'd followed this. They came out of the courtroom, arms up and cheering fans, both bands, and claimed a victory because they got off of Lou's label. But they didn't actually make out put it this way, Lou did pretty well financially from all accounts of people involved. He's never really talked about how much money he got out of that deal, but he did get some.
Well, yeah, in fact, that really, the terms of these out-of-court settlements are really kind of an interesting mystery. Mm-hmm. Along the way, it's I suppose, a little hard to know, and this is, of course, part of what the lawsuits were all about, is how much of this success had to do with Lou Pearlman versus the staff he hired versus the talent of these young men versus just plain old luck. I mean, is it even possible to sort that out very well.
Well, no, I mean, it's pretty subjective in a lot of ways, and everyone involved claims that it was them who discovered the Backstreet Boys. I mean, so, you know, everyone wants credit for it. He definitely shared in the effort with, you know, people like Gene Tansey Williams, who was an early scout for him, with people like Johnny Wright, who continues to be a dominating force in pop music, went on to manage Britney Spears, discover Britney Spears, really. You know, there's people in his life who've done a lot of the heavy lifting, but you got to go back and say he's the guy with the money at the beginning who, it may have been stolen, but it was money, and it was his idea, so...
I want you to tell our listeners about a delicious moment in one of the trials. I don't remember now which group this was, but a very humorous exchange which occurs between one of Lou Pearlman's attorneys and the judge. I don't remember now exactly which judge it was, but this judge sort of cites their own daughters in sort of trying to think about, you know, whose success is this really, and who deserves
right.
the most credit?
Lawyer says to the judge, you know, Your Honor, Lou Pearlman is the, you know, is NSYNC. You know, he is this band. And the judge says, well, wait a minute, really? That's him on that poster in my daughter's bedroom? They said, because it doesn't look like him. It looks like these guys. And in fact, I'd advise you to settle with the other side right now, or I don't think you're going to like the way this ruling goes.
So, of course, one problem which begins to envelop Lou Pearlman is that he is making an extraordinary amount of money off of these groups, and they are being paid, in effect, a pittance, and eventually figure that out, and eventually are able to leave him.
Mm-hmm.
What gets him into even more serious trouble is some of the schemes which he embarks upon at this point in time, probably in part to help finance this lavish lifestyle.
Right.
In particular, something which involves a sort of investment opportunity, EISA, which turns out to be an absolutely brazen case of fraud. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, ESA, EISA stands for Employee Investment Savings Accounts. When he got started on his business, Transcontinental Airlines, which was an entirely fake airline company, not only did he claim it was a huge success, owning 40-some-odd jets, but he said, it's so successful, and I'm such a big wig overseas that I have the ability to invest in banks and get you a better rate, a better interest rate than banks here. They waive fees for me. They make it possible so I can make more money than I would if I invested in the U.S. And because I like you so much and you're an investor in my company, I'll let you give me your savings, and I'll put it in there and set up your own account for you. It's all perfectly legal, and it's backed by the FDIC and the AIG and Lloyd's of London, and you're insured, and you'll have your own account, and I'll get you 2 or 3 percentage points better in interest than you'd get in a bank in the U.S.
And, of course, it was all a lie. And what helped to disguise the lie was his creation of something called Cohen and Siegel.
Uh-huh.
Tell us about this.
Cohen and Siegel was an accounting, supposedly an accounting firm, an independent auditor of all his financial statements that he'd been putting out there since the late 1980s. Whenever he'd give somebody his numbers and show them how successful he was, the reports were always audited by this firm, Cohen and Siegel. They had offices in Germany. They had offices in Coral Gables, Florida. If the names sound familiar, it's because Cohen and Siegel are the names of the founders of Las Vegas. So he pulled these names out of thin air. He created a company that supposedly oversaw his financials, and it was all fake. In the way that it was found out was this gentleman that you mentioned before, the CPA, the former CPA that came in to audit Lou's books in the very end. Noticed that there was some language on one of these audits that was years old. You know, these guys go to conventions every year, and they talk about the standard legal language that should be at the bottom of their audits and what it should do. Well, it gets revised every year, and this one was about 3 years behind. And Paul Glover, the CPA, says, you know, he says he's seen a lot of shoddy work, but this, to not even have the basic language down, is just, you know, kind of takes the cake. So he says, I'm going to call this firm. I'm going to find out what the heck is going on. Picks up his cell phone, he dials the number of Cohen and Siegel in Coral Gables, Florida, And as the phone starts ringing in his ear, he sees the light on Lou's desk light up on his phone. And he thinks, well, that's kind of weird. So he hangs up, dials it again, and the light on Lou's desk rings again. It's because he was Cohen and Siegel. The actual number was a secretarial service in Coral Gables in a storefront that was hired to answer the phone as Cohen and Siegel. And if anyone asked for Lou, say he was unavailable, can I take a message, and then pass the message on to Lou.
Amazing. I mean, and there are all kinds of good people who turned over all kinds of money and essentially lost it all. Mm-hmm. One other quick thing I want to ask you about, because this is something that you actually personally encountered. Lou Pearlman for a while operated, I guess we would sort of call it a talent agency, involved particularly in the whole business of modeling.
Right.
And a really bogus enterprise. And I should mention that I know somebody personally who got taken in by this same kind of overture, approached in the same way that you were on the streets of, was it New York City one
day? Yeah,
even
me. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell our listeners what we're talking about, what this operation was, and the kind of fraud it was perpetrating.
It was called a variety of things, and that's part of the problem. It was everything from Transcontinental Talent to Wilhelmina Scouting Agency, and I feel bad for Wilhelmina, which was a legitimate company that started up and sold its name at one point. But here's the deal. You're walking down the street, and somebody comes up to you and goes, "Are you a model?" And you say, flattered, you say, "No, thanks. You know, have you ever thought about getting into modeling? Because you could really do it." And then you're interested because you're flattered, and the person telling you is generally a decent-looking person. And so they get into the pitch, and what you have to do is show up to a cattle call at 7 p.m. that night, and you go into a room, and they talk about how you could have an exciting future in modeling if you just plunk down $1,000 for a set of photos and an online profile. Well, they were coming just short of promising work in the modeling world, and certainly led people to believe that. And it wasn't happening. They had no way that they could make that happen. They were selling a bill of goods, and this was investigated and went bankrupt before anything was ever proven. Everybody involved in this, just about, at least at the top, had an extensive record of scams and cons and big ones too. It was really a group of hucksters that he got involved with when he started this modeling agency. It was one of the things that started to bring him down.
And it reminds me that one of your words to describe Orlando, Florida, is a huckster's paradise.
Yeah.
In that, and I mean, for one thing, you have all of these young people running around wanting to be the next Britney Spears and
right.
the next Justin Timberlake.
Right.
And you also have all kinds of retirees,
right.
many with income to invest. And boy, you add all of that up together and then put somebody like Lou Pearlman in the middle of it, and it's just a disaster waiting to happen.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, you know, like I said before, the Disney dream, and then all the people who move down there to live out their retirement, and they're thinking they're getting a guaranteed way to bring in a few extra bucks.
So essentially, what ultimately brings him down?
It is this accountant, Paul Glover, who finds all these businesses and hundreds of certified letters from investors demanding their money back. He sees the plain evidence of a scheme, reports him to the authorities instead of playing along like Lou thought he would. As he does that, Lou flees to first Germany by way of Ireland, and then I think makes a stop in Hong Kong on some business at some point, goes eventually to Bali, Indonesia, where he's spotted at the Westin. By a German tourist who knew him because he was the famous guy who had those pop bands in Germany. It's his fame that ultimately undoes him. The feds swoop in the next day and arrest him and bring him back to Guam, where they charge him, and then back to Orlando, where he sat in jail for a long time.
And I guess he made too many bogus promises to too many people. Was he so foolish, so stupid that he wouldn't think they would eventually come looking for their money? Or did he genuinely believe that all of these exploits at some point were going to add up to money coming in? I mean, it's hard to imagine that anybody with a brain could think that. But, I mean, how did he imagine all of this was going to finish?
Well, he still imagines that it will finish with him on top. I mean, he still thinks that just with a little more time and a little more opportunity, he will make everybody whole. That's what he said at his sentencing in jail. That's what he said since then. That's what he's tried to do since then. And he believes that he's a guy who intends well and knows how to do business, and he just needed a little more time.
It's an amazing story. As you finished writing this story, I mean, did you expect it to take you where it did?
No, I mean, it could have gone a bunch of different ways, and you have so many people who are lying because Lou's lying to them, or lying because they're trying to keep themselves out of trouble, or by association. So, you know, you start out giving all those people the benefit of the doubt, and then you just go to disproving things. I guess I did think that he was going to go to jail for a long time. I thought that would happen. The one thing I didn't see coming was the sentence that the judge gave him, in which he offered him sort of the keys to his own cell. And he said, I'm going to give you a 25-year sentence, but for every $1 million that you can come up with to return to your investors, I'll take a month off your sentence. The idea was to give investors comfort, cold comfort in the fact that there isn't a pot of money sitting out there somewhere, because the temptation would be to dig it up and to buy his way out of jail with it. So people were thinking before that he got away with maybe $100 million stashed somewhere. It's not.
Because if he had $100 million someplace, he would have put it towards his own earlier release.
Yes, and, you know, at the end of the day, the court documents cite him for $300 million lost of investors' money, but really, it's probably more like $500 million. Mm. He got 300 months in jail. So, if he pulls out $300 million, he can buy his freedom tomorrow.
Wow! If that money still existed.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it seems not to.
Right.
The story is amazing and so troubling. The book is The Hit Charade. It's published by HarperCollins and the author Tyler Gray. Tyler Gray, this could not have been an easy story to follow and sort out and write about, and I think you've done a great, great job. And I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I really enjoyed this.
All right. Thank you.
This recording was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2008. Again, Lou Pearlman was convicted and sentenced to 25 years in prison. He died in federal custody behind bars in 2016 at the age of 62. This weekend, in the podcast version of The Morning Show, we are going to be rebroadcasting interviews around two different topics around education. Tomorrow, Saturday, an interview from about 20 years ago with Jackie Drummer, who for many years worked with gifted and talented students with the South Milwaukee School District. And she offers some really fascinating thoughts on some of the stimulating challenges that are part of working with gifted and talented students. On Sunday, you'll hear from the author of a book called Same, Different, Equal, which looks at same-sex education. Next week, no morning show on Monday because of Labor Day, but on Tuesday, Dr. Yuri Maltsev, professor of economics, rescheduled from last week, will be coming on the morning show to talk about a topic about which he knows a great deal, the nation of Afghanistan and its troubled history. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. We're approaching 9 o'clock.